Paul and Dave. Dave's calling in even though he's has a sick leave day, so he's, you know, I don't know if he's on medication or not.
Paul, I don't know if I can do this. I really need to have you, like, via satellite up on a screen. This is Renata, Paul.
With, like, a nice background of law books.
Right, and, like, your title.
You're
right. Yeah. Well, it's about to start snowing here, so that could be in the background.
Well, we... thank you also. I think this is all I expect. Kate Mitchell's out, Dawn's out, and I haven't heard anything on Gilder's side, so that leaves, that's 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, that's everybody. So, great. Again, there's a lot on the agenda today, but there's also a good bit of its kind of residual stuff that there may not be many more questions. But before we get started, just a couple things to mention. We're in the hiring process. One of our staff, Bryson, left last month, and I wanted to let everybody know that we are still receiving and reviewing applications for that position. So if anybody knows of somebody, great. It's not too late for them to get an application. Also, we're doing summer internships, so same thing. If you know anybody, you know, former intern from your office, somebody, you know, send them our way. If you have questions about that, let me know. But we definitely have some strong applicants for the attorney position and the intern slots, and hope to move on those soon.
Folks have sent in resumes or applied.
Yeah, for the just like numbers of applications,
yeah.
for the, you know, it's over 100 for the attorney position.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we did a, you know, it's always interesting. We posted at some law schools, we posted on some like general online places. You never know how people hear, but it does seem like. Anyway, so we've had a lot of applicants and interns also, probably, I don't know, 50?
Oh, probably a little more than that.
Yeah, you know, 50 plus. So so we have a lot, and again, some strong folks, but haven't made, we have a couple of interns locked in, but there's still more slots there. So just want to put that out there if you know of anybody. Second, just, you know, I like to always... You know, follow up on the data issue, which, you know, I know is a, you know, we finally got back a kind of an updated data set from the court, which we've been waiting on a little over 4 months, almost 5 months, kind of, which initially they said it'd probably be a few weeks. So we're happy to finally get that. It includes attempt, data fields so that we can separate out attempts, which seems to be a huge deal, right? And so it also... does a few other tweaks. So with that, again, hopefully we're going to be able to get out some kind of updated numbers kind of across the board for frequencies and penalties. The Sentencing Commission has put out some, you know, public data on felonies, right? It's only felonies. So some of that information's out there in some form. But we hope to at least share with you all kind of more in-depth information and dealing with misdemeanors. And if you have any particular data questions, please, you know, let me know and we can see if we can address it or not, or it might take some time. Again, we kind of work with a data analyst over in the Office of the City Administrator. So.
Tell, do you think you'll be able to tell, or at least you probably haven't done any analysis yet, whether attempts is anything other than a plea offense? No, you can't.
I don't know that we're ever going to be able to, like, you know. There will be indicators, I think, that, right, like, you know, some instances of attempts, such and such, every single one is a plea. And, you know, you could see that, like, it's coming out of a case where initially these were the charges, and every time it goes, like... It will be strongly suggestive, okay. but we'll never be able to, I think, kind
it's
of...
It's not a field, but you something about the data you can tell.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
I mean, you know, you can tell if it's a plea or not, and you can tell kind of what the final charges were and how you can kind of see a bit how it evolved. But, you know, there's a tremendous amount of, right, decision-making that's invisible from the way those stats are gathered. Next meeting, March 7th, kind of the same time, 10 a.m. to noon, and we'll remind everybody the deadline for this batch of offenses against persons, materials that are out for your review is March 2nd. So, those announcements out of the way. Wanted to.
Ask for an extension. I don't know. I'm going to be in trial.
Disregarding the whispering in the room. unless. all right, so. Property offenses. I really am.
Fortune can hear a hoot.
I
don't know if you can, Paul, but
we're whispering about the seeking an extension.
Representative
and Richard is pretending.
Oh yeah, I did hear you whispering, but I couldn't hear what you were saying. Yeah.
It was the defense was whispering about an extension, and then the government said
the
that
federal the government did
the
not
the federal
oppose.
Government would not oppose.
got it.
If there was anyone else who wanted to join in the request.
an esteemed former federal prosecutor.
Oh, wait. takes no position.
Very good. All right. Well, let's let's proceed onward. We may be in it. Some of you may be in another shutdown in another, 24 hours or something. Isn't it?
Really?
Like,
that's
isn't it like
true.
That's
really.
Mean,
I just.
Oh my gosh.
If there are other delays that, arise, we can revisit. But I think, let's talk about property offenses. So there's not. We've gone over a lot of terrain on this in prior meetings. Okay. There was one thing that I wanted to, Rachel address, arising out of a particularly, so what we kind of had left were the theft type offenses and a few definitions. Again, we've jumped around and actually addressed a number of, many of the other definitions, et cetera. One thing, though, that we did want to get the group's thoughts on was a comment that PDS had made on the definition of motor vehicle, which plays out then in several offenses. And I put the comment up on the screen, I'll just to kind of recite it for those of you listening at home or at your office. So the PDS comment was that I'll read it. The term motor vehicle should more clearly exclude modes of transportation that can be propelled by human effort. A, quote, moped can be propelled by a small engine, but it can also be pedaled, meaning it can operate simply as a bicycle. It should not qualify as a motor vehicle. Also, the definition should be clear that it is a truck tractor that is a motor vehicle. A semi-trailer or trailer, if detached from the truck tractor, is not a motor vehicle. And then they give an example of rewriting the definition using those two things. Rachel can jump in and correct me. We use this in theft as well because we have this kind of gradation distinction based on whether it's a motor vehicle. But UUV, obviously.
Sergeant News offenses regarding the VIN number, at least
that's
one.
Right, alteration vehicle identification
arson.
Number. And we've so far been basically trying to use a consistent definition, right, of what a motor vehicle is. At least for, again, the revised offenses. We're not, I know Dave has a, there are a bunch of other, particularly Title 50 offenses that have to do their own thing. We haven't thought about that. But for what we, the offenses before us, this notion of you know, where do you draw the line kind of at the bottom, right? In our proposal, we had basically said it's anything with an electric or gas motor would qualify. And I think PDS raises a valid point that particularly with all the new technology, you know, there are the motorized skateboards out now. There are motorized bicycles. There's one parked out front of our building this morning. Increasingly, we see these kind of low power, little electric motors in small little things like this. And technically, as the way we had proposed it, those would be motor vehicles, right? Because they have an electric motor. I think it's valid to say, like, look, do we really, you know, do you want to sweep in these electric assist bicycles, for instance, right? And so just wanted to kind of open that up for folks' thoughts, both in terms of, you know, fine, where the policy should go, but also, like, how do you articulate it, right? You know, kind of as a drafting matter and draw the line. PDS put out this one line in...
Can I just say about the trailer? I didn't think I was doing something differently than you.
The trailer's kind of separate, yeah.
Right, okay. But so, okay. I didn't mean that to be a substantive change.
No, it's not. The thing that I would just point out is that moped is actually included in the definition of motor vehicle through a DCCA case law for UUV. And so that is why that is in there, as well as, I believe, all-terrain vehicle. So any kind of discussion about excluding modes of transportation that could be propelled by human effort could potentially be overturning DCCA case law, which is fine, potentially. But just to point that out, that's why moped was in there or is in there.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah. Thoughts, opinions on this? I think, again, like, this is an area where, like, actually technological change matters, right? And I think, you know, doing a laundry list, while it might help, like we're kind of did here, to like be very clear about some common objects, you know, I don't even know how you describe some of the, like, Michael's, you know, the like the motorized skateboard type things, or, you know, like the two wheel, what are those even called?
Hoverboard things?
Hoverboard is
stand
like,
on and
yeah, right, but yeah. But essentially, it's almost like a little mini Segway, right? Like, it's like, you know, like, yeah. These things that are out now that they balance, they have electric motors. You know, I don't know what's it going to be next in 5 years. And again, like, these, like, as they become cheaper and smaller, it seems like you get to a point where the danger, right, like, of a collision by somebody on one of these little electric things seems, you know, far less than, right, far, far less than an automobile.
Although that's not what we're using it for any of this. It's not danger by the motor vehicle. It's if it's so far been treated in what we've done so far as unbelievably valuable property.
Right.
And cars are not.
Right. No.
Motorized skateboards.
That's right. That's right. Cars are not motorized skateboards.
Write that down.
Gotcha. On board with that.
We're
all agree. Anyway, so this just kind of begs the question. Again, there are standards out there, you know, auto theft, right? Like, it is a category in kind of many, if not most, criminal codes. I don't remember offhand. You know, it's we have not specifically examined where
for criminal history scoring.
I'm sorry?
This is gonna matter for criminal history scoring.
It will matter. Yes.
Because this is going to sweep in, a very broad definition is going to, rule of lenity, sweep in probably other jurisdictions that do define motor vehicle to be more like a car. And we're going to be like, hey, maybe, you know, right? No, it actually works the reverse. Ours
would be the broader, I think.
You're right.
You know, on that respect. I mean... Yeah. So again, I just kind of open that up for any thoughts about where to draw the line here. I think PDS raises a valid point, which is, again, at the lower end, where are we drawing a line? And is it simply...
Can I?
Yeah. Please.
I was going to just chime in for a second. While I'm not, I got to think about the existing case law, and in general, I think the position we've taken is not to overrule current law. So, but even without overruling current law, I understand that the comment PBS is making, and I think the way that they do it in traffic-related offenses in a lot of jurisdictions is to talk about the maximum power output of the motor. In other words, a motor capable of going more than 5 miles an hour, that kind of a thing. Because there's always an exception for, like, motorized wheelchairs and things like that. So you can build in a power output into it if you want to really distinguish between low-powered vehicles and high-powered vehicles. When I first got PBS's, I saw their comment, I went to the internet to try to look at mopeds, and I don't think you could just say moped, because there is a gray area between mopeds and motorcycles. And so I think if we're going to do it, we have to base it something about the type of the engine or the output.
Yeah, that makes sense, frankly. Again, if you're going to draw some line, it needs to be a technically consistent and clean line. The other hand, like, having to present evidence of the power output of the,
And that assumes that power output, and maybe it is always directly proportionate to value. Because it seems to me that in the theft UUV context, that's actually what PDS's concern is, if I understand that correctly. It's like...
A little bit. Mostly I didn't want to end up in bicycle land. But yes, I mean, some, with respect to... I'm trying to remember, it's now been so long. In theft, there's some of the gradations based on, right, we have a motor vehicle that's worth a lot and then a base motor vehicle. So there is some distinction, right? You probably don't have a moped that is valued at more than $25,000. God, I hope not. But for the most part, and certainly the way, say, robbery is written, it's just motor vehicle. As if it would be the substitute for carjacking to take somebody's little motorized skateboard or something. So to me, when we say it's like the danger, it's the problem with talking about robbery and where we put it in it covers pickpocketing, right? You have a motor vehicle, you think it's a motor vehicle, you think it's a car, and everyone is going to react to it that way, and it turns out it covers really low-level stuff. So it's not. So some of it is monetary value, and some of it is as if it's, partly we punish it as if, even if what we're talking about is carjacking, because it's so valuable and it encloses me and it's, it's like driving around in my car, and that's just not the case with these other things. So I'm saying it's sort of all the baggage that comes with calling something a motor vehicle and how we punish doing anything to it when we're writing a definition that sweeps in so much more. So that's what I'm reacting to, is trying to be like, okay, what's car-like versus what's bike-like, or why didn't you just walk?
Part of it seems like it's having a passenger, like the ability to have a passenger and the added safety that you need with that. You're
gotcha.
Having a passenger on some of these things.
That's, yeah. It strikes me too that, like, other, in terms of the effective harm to the individual, right? Usually we measure that in terms of dollar value of the loss, but also, like, to the extent that somebody's relying on their car as a mode of transportation, right?
It
has a real life impact.
That you're in your home.
Right, you have an expectation of privacy and reliance on this device in a way that, like, can really interfere with your life if it's, stolen. Now, again, how many people use their hoverboards to, get to work? I don't know, right? So these things kind of just diminish the expectation of privacy, the all these things kind of diminish when you get more towards the it's an electric bike or an electric skateboard, right? Like, you know, but it seems like a sliding scale, and we just have to draw a line somewhere here. I think I don't know of any jurisdiction. Again, we have not. It would be a muddle, I dare say, because jurisdictions have a lot of different definitions. They're tucked in various places for, you know, motor vehicle. We could try to sort this out, but like I suspect, again, this is something. There's been a big change just in the last like 3 years, right? In like the cheapness, essentially. You know, like now they're mass producing these like the electric bikes, the like electric other like small things. So my guess is we're not going to find much guidance in norms in other jurisdictions. This is kind of a new issue out there because of the technology being so much cheaper. And yeah.
Would a drone fit into that definition of your view? I don't. Self-propelled.
Oof. It's an interesting question.
I can't hear anything. I had asked
whether folks believe that a drone would fit into our current definition of motor vehicle.
I sort of feel like what ends up happening is it depends on what a vehicle is, right? Because the or other vehicle, doesn't that end up telling you a lot about the previous list?
Yeah.
At least I thought it did.
Yeah.
Right? So. I mean, in a vehicle, it seems like it has to carry a person, I think, right? I assume that's what
a vehicle
is.
If you think about the way you use vehicle in general, it means something that is a means of transport. And the way companies are even using these as a vehicle for delivery of goods. I just threw it out there. I don't have a position. I'm just trying to get some feedback so I can consider it.
I do think that some jurisdictions, many jurisdictions...
In Title 50, the definition of a vehicle has to do with wheels and things being dragged or on wheels or tractor or being pulled by animals.
Right.
Or something like that. So a drone couldn't be, at least for Title 50 purposes,
right.
A drone would not be included.
Yeah, but like, you know.
And that's why there's different definitions between vehicle and motor vehicle. They're not defined the same way in Title 50.
Gotcha.
Yeah, looking up the dictionary definition, if Dave was here, he would be doing this. You know, for vehicle, you know, Webster's would say it's, put aside the, an agent of transmission or carrier, a medium through which something is expressed, achieved, or displayed, a means of carrying or transporting something.
Right. Huh.
So I think, again, you know, and I think, again, you know, they now have the little, they're doing the tests for like the little drone deliveries that aren't like airborne, but are like wheels, right? You know, going around neighborhoods doing stuff. And again, to the extent, you know, we're trying to look 5 years down the road or something that, you know, is not immediately antiquated, it seems like going down the road, it's tough to go down the road of being drawing a technical line in the sand about a certain power level or certain wheel, you know, the wheels, this, you know, doing the laundry list, it's tough because then it turns out that amount of power is totally enough in 5 years
question.
To power something else.
I propose
so.
That we add something definition about people.
Human,
but,
right.
But Rachel was going to say something. What were you?
Just similar to what Dave was saying, many jurisdictions, several jurisdictions will have... a separate definition of vehicle that will have something about like wheels or intended to transport people over land or sea or something, so you can narrow it to at least then potentially people, goods. So that's certainly an area of further research to try and we had looked at this a little bit several months ago, but to review that research and just see could vehicles somehow be limited so it's not a drone for just pizza delivery or something.
Those things have wheels. Go down the sidewalk with a little the minder.
Yeah.
But if they don't like maybe something like designed or able to hold people or something.
Yeah.
That'd be a bigger on them.
I mean,
I guess it depends on what you're concerned about. In the theft context, you're concerned about one thing. In the sort of a Title 50 context, there's something different that you're concerned about. And specifically in the theft, but carjacking specifically context, there's something else you're also concerned about.
But it probably is all people. Like, it's probably not whatever this
That's
thing
right.
that goes on the
yeah,
ground or drones in the air. Right? I mean, for any of it. Like, that's more
right.
like, probably, maybe we can have agreement. That's more like property. That stealing, that's like stealing your computer. It's not okay, and it could be worth a lot, but it's not stealing a car.
Right.
I don't know whether there's drunk drone driving. Dave. It was running, and you were nearby with the key.
If you're operating it, it's drunk.
Yeah.
If you're operating it.
That's my new neurosis.
If you're not driving it, I don't know.
Right, if it's a self-driving car and you're in it, you know, like, there's a world in there, yeah.
Let's just get
anyway.
Rid of it.
Yeah, exactly. just get it off. Well, okay, so we will look at this a bit more. It sounds like some sort of language about persons, right, is kind of reasonable, it sounds like, or possibly acceptable to everybody. Where, again, you kind of draw the line as to, like, human-powered, you know, this, I like the conceptual kind of approach of saying, well, can it be effectively moved by human power? My worry is that it goes up too far, right? Like, again, like, you know, that, right, like, mopeds, yeah, maybe those are close enough on the side of a motorcycle, right? Or like a car. And yeah, but you know, technically they can be human powered. I don't know. On watercraft, like, you know, what does it mean to then talk about it being possibly, you know, human powered? You know, you get arguing, you're like, is a sailboat? Well, you know, like, at what point does, these are tough line drawing questions, and it seems like the human powered motorized, like, these are like some clean cutoffs.
Well, that's
but
why
I'm not
I
sure if any of them
do something with watercraft as well that try to take advantage of that, like, try to acknowledge sailboats,
right. Right, and it may be that, like, we can take care of some of the major categories like this with, like, the difference between a sailboat and a dinghy or a rowboat. And I don't, you know, I'm from Nebraska. I was born in Nebraska, so these distinctions don't mean a whole. But, like, at some what point does the rowboat, you know,
desert,
at what
Nebraska.
Point does, like, you know, can you not say that I could propel this watercraft by putting a paddle outside, and so it doesn't count, right?
Right. So sailboat can be powered by sail, or you can motor it in to dock it.
Right. Typically, it's not designed to use for human propulsion, but, like, at some point,
would it be on, like, a road? Oh, but you're talking about theft.
Yeah.
See, I keep confusing whether we're talking about things that are concerned about a roadway.
I called a sailor.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the primary principle, the thing that we're most concerned about, is primary mode of transportation by human. I mean, there are a lot of different ways you could draw the line. Like, so, for example, if you look at the carjacking legislative history, and again, I know it's a little bit different, right? The legislative history talks a lot about, like, the importance of cars, how people rely on them. And so when we're talking about grading theft, like, the social harm is typically the proxy is the value. But the thing is that, like, when it's a car and it's the thing that you typically rely on, like, even if whatever the value of the car itself is not as much, like, because
right.
people rely on cars in a different way, like, that seems to be the sort of, like, the animating principle that gets at, like, why you would want to have a quicker bump up for vehicle than anything else. And so, you know, I mean, because there are a lot of different ways you can kind of look at it. You know, so is it a boat, a vehicle, or is it, like, but it seems like, and again, this is not something necessarily you could codify, but it seems like that's kind of the basic policy rationale, you know? Whereas, like, if you took someone's, like, weekend boat, right? Like, or something, you know, like,
it's just
well, you guys
theft.
Have water. So I do have, we did comment on watercraft. It's at our comments on page 10. And we proposed, so you didn't end up with a rubber raft, because you went, because it ends up mattering with arson and things like that, I think is where you started caring about watercraft, presumably to, like, cover a houseboat, although, anyway, that's a dwelling. But we proposed watercraft means a vessel for travel by water that has a permanent mast or a permanently attached engine. So you don't get rowboats, but you could get a sailboat. You could also get quite a small, dinky little sailboat, but, you know, whatever. So that was a very different, and I did actually get in touch with a sailor, too.
The one comment I had about that was whether you meant to include outboard motors, or because that's worded, I had trouble understanding that, inboard motors and outboard motors. And did you mean to exclude outboard motors, such, or do we need to rework that a little to make sure that?
Well, I think of my grandpa's boat. Right, outboard motors can be permanently attached, right? I'm not thinking of yachts, I'm thinking of a motorboat.
Yeah, I don't know what, you know, does permanent mean like it's bolted down? Does it mean like, you know, right? Like, it does seem like there's a...
That was where I came in.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, that's exactly where I came in. Because when I looked at outboard motors, I actually found boats with, you know, 20 outboard motors attached to them. So the question was, it couldn't simply be that easy, unfortunately. So we have to define it better. I agree, a rowboat shouldn't count, but the ease at which you detach the motor should make the difference either. Because you just Google it and you'll see all sorts of ways that you have fairly large, if not yachts, at least certainly ships, not boats, that have easily detachable motors.
I don't want to take too much of our time today on this issue, but if anybody has more thoughts on this, you know, let us know. I can see a lot of value in also just like wherever the line's drawn here, being very clear about it, such that there is an argument, because in all of these cases, besides UUV, there is the property offenses otherwise provide, you know, liability for the theft, or, you know, so it's not about, for at least for property offenses and apart from UUV, it's not about excluding liability. It's about whether it's getting a bump, whether it's being treated a little differently.
Can I ask about watercraft?
Yeah.
It looks like from our comments we wrote about it in the context of arson, and maybe that's where it is. And I guess I want to think about, or encourage you all to think about, what's the point of watercraft that isn't captured by value gradations and the definition of dwelling? That it's like, is it a remnant of an earlier time? And in the same way we are not covering horse-drawn carriages, we don't otherwise need to cover watercraft. Mm-hmm. In the same way we've been talking about, there is a difference with cars that's beyond monetary value that we want to do something to protect more, treat differently. And that maybe watercraft just isn't one of those things for us anymore. If you're not living in it, then is it just about how much money it costs? Could it be just about how much money it costs?
Yes.
In which case, we don't need to treat it differently at all.
This goes to, again, like, what is the special social harm that we're trying to address through the special treatment of motor vehicles? If it's not,
right.
If it's not a dwelling, Michael suggested, to the extent the goal here was to address kind of main forms of transportation that impact people's lives if they're deprived of it. The privacy angle and kind of expectation of privacy in cars, a little elevated again. Is that as true for non-enclosed spaces? A motorcycle, I don't know. You know, besides mode of transportation, what rationale kind of, you know, we want to make distinct and penalize distinctly in property offenses.
So, okay, well, think about it. Is it just arson in those sort of, is that where watercraft is showing up? Was it in, it's not separately treated in theft or anything, is
well,
it? Or did it end up in a
on,
property in
on
some kind
trespass,
of definition?
We have it coming up in trespass.
Burglary.
And then in burglary on top of that.
Because entering someone's raft.
Entering somebody's.
Fucking scary.
Yeah. Raft, one thing.
Is it wrapped into some other larger category of property that it then, it like is in offenses that, but it disappears? Like we don't see it? It's slightly invisible, masked?
I mean,
no.
It is always.
It's a standalone.
Property. I mean, like.
Right. But it's not. I can't think of an example. Like how services, you know, how labor was built and services was built in property, or
I mean,
where you had to kind of
I think
take
motor vehicles where, you know, it potentially, right, again, is nested within motor vehicle. You can go back again to your...
Okay, I just...
I think that's the one that you already...
There is no other definition that has it on a list, something like water.
That's right.
Okay.
All right, well, let me open it up a bit more broadly on the property offenses. Again, we've done a lot already on many items, but I wanted to just kind of see, you know, if there was any other comments that you had all raised that you, you know, wanted to talk about with the full group. Anything else remaining on property offense, you know, definitions or theft or... Or, you know, maybe it's something that we've covered before that you wanted to revisit, but otherwise I'd say we should move forward to conspiracy and the comments on that.
I'm scared.
All right. So hearing nothing voiced out loud, at least, Laura with her whispering campaigns again, we will move on to conspiracy and, you know, the comments we got back there and, you know, in some sense it's very detailed and complex, and in other sense, you know, in the end the language is relatively short. There were just a few comments that we received back, and I'll let Michael kind of address if there's anything to raise. But again, if there's anything, I'll turn to Michael.
Yeah, so just a few, I think, that we'd like to talk about that we're happy to talk about anything else. We got back comments from PDS and OAG. So one comment, PDS recommended limiting conspiracy liability to felonies. Gives a few different rationales. Something staff is definitely open to considering. There's one kind of empirical point made by PDS, which would be interesting to get USAO or OAG's take, which is like whether or not, as just a matter of practice, whether conspiracy to commit misdemeanors is ever charged in the district.
Yeah, and I will say, like again, like our stats, we haven't gone fully down that road. From the little we've done, it doesn't seem like we can kind of fully distinguish, like we see conspiracy, you know, that you can filter this out, but like we may be able to do a better job, but right now we can't link it fully to like what the underlying predicate offense is in the data set we have. Anyway, so we'll try to do this, but so it's an open question. This is like, right, is it really only in practice used for, you know, five different offenses and they're all major felonies, and like, you know, like we have no kind of sense of that. Again, the overall conspiracy numbers are pretty low, but they exist too. So anyway, just an empirical question out there. If anybody has experience or knowledge of any conspiracy charges in misdemeanor cases, or
anybody
run across this before?
So that's one point. you know, another, you know, so just to say, as a matter of practice, it looks like there's at least like five or six jurisdictions that limit it to felonies, Texas, Virginia. So it's definitely not an unheard of practice. And yeah, so, you know, I'd say there are a few proportionality concerns raised, some of which we may be better situated a little bit, you know, maybe in a few months to address. You know, so first, you know, one point or question I guess PDS raises says something that since the what we released doesn't specify gradations, that it appears likely conspiracy would be criminalized as a felony. And so I'm not sure that's true. So I think what we would generally be proposing would be a proportionate penalty discount along the same lines as with respect to attempt. And so in that case, you know, it very well could be that conspiracy to, not only would a conspiracy to attempt to commit a misdemeanor be a misdemeanor, but also potentially a conspiracy to commit, you know, a low-level felony. But, you know, so we'll be a little bit better situated to address that in a few months. Also, you know, questions as to, like, merger and, you know, how that's dealt with between the conspiracy and the complete offense. So, you know, I think we'll, once we've set the penalties and kind of dealt with the merger rules for general inchoate crimes, we'll probably be in a little bit better situated to get a sense of what proportionality issues are there. But, you know, it's definitely something worth considering. The second major comment OAG had to do with conspiracy to defraud. You know, we talked about this, I think, in some earlier meetings, but, you know, OAG's point is that if by eliminating the conspiracy to defraud clause, something that's currently criminal would no longer be criminal, that should be dealt with specifically. And so, you know, the only thing that seemed that would seem likely to be cut out is, because keep in mind that, you know, you'd always be able to charge conspiracy to commit fraud as our fraud offense. And so the question is, what wouldn't be captured by conspiracy to commit the offense of fraud that is captured currently under the district's general conspiracy statute, which has this more general conspiracy to defraud language. You know, the one clear thing that I think would be the sort of like honest services type fraud. But I think, you know, we had talked a little bit about specifically addressing political corruption statutes individually, and that sort of the modern trend is to specifically deal with conspiracies to commit particular types of political corruption through specific offenses, rather than sort of like relying on very general amorphous conspiracy to defraud language. But you know, OAG was right to flag it. It's a good point, and you know, as things move forward, if any of the agencies come across specific fact patterns or issues or things that, you know, feel
or
like...
Or political conspiracies.
Right.
There's any agency that...
Right. Yeah, that too. You know, something definitely to flag. So the next comment had to go... there's another comment by OAG to deal with unilateral conspiracies. So, you know... You know, OAG in their comments seemed to indicate that they were not able to find any case where, you know, a conspiracy conviction was based upon two people where one of the people is an undercover officer. It seems that in general, so our statute uses the two or more persons language, and so does the federal statute. That sort of like two or more persons language is generally thought of to be a sort of like the classic indicator of a bilateral approach to conspiracy. And in the federal courts, under the Sears rule, you know, the unilateral conspiracies are not, you know, do not provide the basis for general conspiracy liability. There doesn't really seem to be any clear precedent supporting a unilateral construction of light of current district authority. If to understand their comment, you know, if they're recommending that as a policy matter that DC should shift to, you know, a clear unilateral regime, you know, that's something that could be con- considered, but that would seem to be a pretty clear change in law, which, you know, there are policy reasons that, you know, to support that, but, you know, so yeah, that's something that we could consider. Dave, is there anything else you wanted to add on that?
No, I don't have my notes in front of me, and so the way I feel right now, probably just better off staying quiet. Sorry.
So, OAG, PDS offered a bunch of different sort of like clarificatory revisions. The only one I think worth noting right now, PDS is definitely correct that the or should be an and.
Thank you.
Use of the disjunctive. So that's definitely well taken and will be incorporated. Also with respect to the jurisdictional issue, I think staff definitely agrees that the term immaterial should be struck, and that, you know, this goes to PDS's point that at least in some circumstances, it could be relevant, the legality, you know, where a conspiracy is formed outside of the district to commit a conspiracy inside of the district, the fact that the conduct of the heart of the conspiracy wouldn't be criminal outside of the district could at least potentially be relevant. I think striking immaterial is definitely the right move. Whether or not to add that additional clause, the however it may be relevant to whether the defendant acted with the mental states, that seemed to us to maybe be more of like a commentary point than a statutory point.
One thing I sort of noted, particularly if you're going to take out immaterial, is the title should no longer say irrelevant.
Yes.
It should say like no defense.
I think that's right too. Yeah, I think that's definitely right too. I think that's right, and we're, you know, staff's on board. And then the only thing we wanted to raise, so OAG had a comment about where we use DC code, OAG wanted to use district law. I think that, you know, on the basis that there are, I'm just looking at the language, you know, I think the OAG's basic rationale is that there are crimes that are not contained in the DC code but would fall under district law, and we want to be clear about those. You know, so I guess, you know, staff was just curious as to what, you know, more specifically OAG had in mind there.
Yeah.
DC code, I believe, and I got this from Legal Counsel Division, this wasn't one that that I had originally caught on to, but my understanding, and maybe Laura or Renata can chime in as well, is that code offenses, at the very least, have to do with, what is definitely not a code offense is anything in DCMR, which is a crime but is not a code offense. Also, code offenses, when passed by the city council, can be the codification council can codify it either in the code or in the DCMR if it has to do with a non-enacted offense. So that's the best I could explain it right now. If we need more detail, I could get Josh to explain it.
What crimes are in the DCMR and where do those come from? Does the council pass the DCMR and create crimes? Because if it ain't the council...
Both
what?
No, with the DCMR is actually both council passed and non-council passed. So the council reserves its right to pass DCMR either in entire sections or to overrule agency action. So it does both. There is a class, however, that is delegated to agencies to criminalize.
Do you happen
to... So if you talk about council action, it would definitely include it.
Do you happen to know whether there are... Is there such a thing as an agency created crime?
Yeah.
Is that possible?
Yeah. So it basically the regulatory type offenses, right? So, What did I say?
I take it that's just fines.
Like you know, no, you can, prison penalties up to a certain extent, right? So, like, one I stumbled on lately was, like, you know,
up to a year.
Yeah, like rat harborage, right? There's an offense in the code, right? Like, again, like, we, you know, right? You know, and it's like, I don't remember if it's like 90 days or a year, but, like, you know, right? And, you know, it's somebody who has a notice to clean out their property. It's hard, you know, it's infested with rats. It's a, you know, it's a public nuisance, essentially, the neighborhood. Anyway, at some point along the way, that was...
But, you know, I mean, there's...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but I don't want to necessarily just focus on those.
No. That,
there's a split, like, practicing medicine without a license is, I think, a council-created crime, if I remember, whereas, and dentistry is, but there are other health professional ones which DOH has as practicing without a license.
So
that's could be an example of it as well.
And a few of these are prosecuted, just to be clear. Like, there are some DCMR crimes entailing criminal punishments that are prosecuted and convicted, right? Like, there's not many of them from some of the, like...
Like noise. There are lots. There are hundreds.
Like what?
There are hundreds of them that are on the books.
Noise? Yes, there are hundreds and hundreds on the books. There are very few that are actually, like, you know, actively used, or at least, you know, charged and prosecuted.
At any one time.
Yeah.
They come in waves.
You know, one, I believe, and Dave, you might know this, someone like, it's like a BB gun type, it's like possession of a BB gun. Does this ring a bell for you at all, Dave? Anyway, there are...
Yeah,
there are a few in the DCMR that are particularly weapon-like, dealing with, you know, kind of some low-level... behavior around weapons that are amongst those that, like, we actually see showing up in the stats from
change do to the prosecutor turf war? Conspiracy to harbor rats to be prosecuted by...
the current general conspiracy statute is, you know, conspires to commit a crime, and this one is also conspires to commit a crime. Dave's point is going to just, like, the narrow jurisdictional piece, and what we've basically done, so the current version of the general conspiracy statute uses the phrase all acts of Congress applicable exclusively to the District of Columbia. This was passed in the 70s. And so we just recommended supplanting that with DC code as a better sort of reflection of, you know, the offenses we're talking about. And I think another alternative would be acts of Congress or the DC Council applicable exclusively to the District of Columbia. I mean, you know, the sort of, like, more general, like, what does the... you know, the scope of the general conspiracy statute.
Sue, can I ask you to pull that after we're done, the language that you're talking about, and send it to me?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Good.
Okay, interesting.
More generally, this is a valid point, right? Like, we, offhand, nothing's leaping to mind, but I dare say other places, right, we should be careful about references to DC code offenses versus... district offenses. We should be careful about it, however we end up choosing on it.
So
if you guys want more from Josh, feel free to ask, and I can probably get him to do something more articulate than what I'm capable of doing right now.
Okay. Was there anything else on conspiracy that anybody else wanted to raise on, you know, the recommendations out there? Otherwise, we can move forward to some of the more recent stuff that's out there. All right. Hearing nothing there, let's go ahead and move forward to kind of, you know, the documents that are now out for review, which are mainly offenses against persons. But, you know, there are a couple other things in there about penalties for attempts. And, you know, following up on some of the prior conversations, updating a bit of the language for the culpable mental states. I wanted to say a few things, really just highlight things that were said in the memo that went out with the property offenses, because, you know, we're in a more ideal world, we, you know, would again kind of put together a giant package so that all these things can be looked at holistically, and then we tear it apart, and then we go back and we put it together again. So a few things to highlight, and again, I'm looking at advisory group memo number 15 that we sent out. But regarding criminal attempt penalties, I wanted to highlight...
Memo 15?
Yeah, the so memo the 15. So this is where you would have seen some stats. Right? So this is not, like, there are no recommendations in it. This was, like, kind of, like, supplementary stuff that we sent out. It was
memo 15.
Yeah, advisory group memo 15. It was sent out December 21st with the other materials.
Okay, persons, not property.
I'm sorry, yes.
Okay.
Persons, yes. And, as well as the, again, attempts. That kind of criminal attempt and a couple other things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on criminal attempts... what I wanted to highlight was that, so the proposal out there is to basically have an across-the-board, you know, under the general attempt language, penalties would be up to 50% of whatever the maximum imprisonment was otherwise for the target offense. And, our thought was to, you know, put this out there and prospectively be aware of that, right? And if it causes problems, you have to, let us know, right? Like, again, this is a default rule to which there can be exceptions, right? So, but I just wanted to be clear that, like, you know, at this point, we're not pitching any exceptions, right? And so when we do the second draft for property offenses, you know, we're not planning to do any, but if you think there should be, let us know, right? And same thing going forward, you know, just bear that in mind that, like, this is kind of the first time we have a penalty out there. And we thought it was just so important because, you know, starting to evaluate, you know, offenses against persons where, you know, there, this is one of the places where at least, you know, it seems like there's less rationality into how attempts and penalties are created. I think, you know, there's a lot of historical reasons why, for instance, robbery, you know, has this very low attempt number, and others, it's much higher. Bottom line, you know, it's kind of all across the board, right? Like, we see a lot of different effects for different offenses, and we feel like the 50% number, or, you know, across the board treatment, that kind of consistency, it's going to change a lot for different statutes in different ways, some up, some down. Anyway, so please just, we put that out there as a default going forward. You know, if you have, opinions about that, we won't always specifically raise it. All right. Like, you know, we won't be like, so we're going to do, like, you know, child neglect soon and child abuse. So, you know, we probably won't be, although I suppose we could, which just stepped out, kind of specifically address, well, and the attempt penalty for this would change in this way. We can try to do that, and that might be a helpful thing to flag. On other matters, you know, the definitions for offenses against persons. We put out a number of new definitions. We hope those will be consistent across the board. So far, we haven't run into problems. We did have to, again, in this last batch, we kind of tweaked slightly the definitions for, like, effective consent. You know, just consent and say, like, well, and for property offenses, it means this. So what we're hoping to do, to the extent possible, is have, kind of one consistent definition for these things. Now, again, we may need to say, like, and for property offenses, here's this other little angle. But it may be that we can't always do that. It may be that the definitions are just, like, fundamentally different. It isn't like, you know, for property offenses, it's this, and for offenses against persons, it's that plus something. It may be that they're just different and we can't do it. So far, we haven't encountered that. Okay, so again, we're gonna keep trying to do that, but I just wanted to be kind of flag that. You know, that's how we're proceeding. Flagged in the memo with regard to assault in particular. You're going to see this, but you know, any place where effective consent is a potential defense. We are still examining whether to kind of explicitly in the statute say something about whether minors can give effective consent, in what cases, and I also mentioned, you know, incompetent persons, right? It gets really sticky really fast, right, in how to handle this. I think going forward, we are going to recommend that the definition of effective consent exclude incompetent persons, but would not exclude, for instance, vulnerable persons, right? So we have on the books, you know, we have these kinds of, you know, neglect of a vulnerable person or elderly person, and, you know, these are people who the definition of vulnerable person would include persons who are incompetent, but it also includes people who are competent but have, again, some other either mental or physical limitation that you know brings them within that. The worry on all, or the difficulty on a lot of this is, again, we don't want to disempower, right? You know, people who are competent to make choices, right? And this is particularly tricky in some of the sex abuse world. And we've, you know, again, kind of started to look at that more. again, the model penal code that the ALI has been working to update its recommendations for sex offenses, and you know, it's just very complex. You hit issues of, you know, a husband and wife, and a sexual encounter, and you know, one person is no longer competent because of Alzheimer's, or you know, like there are just some really difficult issues that kind of come up. Maybe they're edge issues, maybe they're not. Maybe they're, you know, but where, again, we want to be careful about saying who can consent. And it may, again, it may be a little different for sex offenses where, you know, there's some kind of fundamentally different. You know, it is not an inherently harmful activity. It is an activity that could or could not be harmful, depending on consent, versus, you know, assaultive conduct which, okay, maybe some low-level, you know, can be consented to, and that's kind of the way it's, you know, kind of pitched. Not more, you know, very severe forms. Anyway, I will say this too, that, you know, like, not only does, you know, there's nothing in the current, right, like, you know, simple assault is common law, so, you know, defined in the common law in the district. Other jurisdictions have not done, there's no magic formula out there for how to deal with consent in assault-type offenses and other type offenses. We've done the best that we can, kind of, and we talk about it in the commentary, you know, where other jurisdictions are. The ALI does have kind of, you know, some language in its defenses that deals with consent. Anyway, I just want to flag this as an area that we're continuing to work on, you know, it gets very thorny, particularly around issues of competency and minority. Again, like, you know, it might be easy to say for purposes of contracts that no person under 18 can consent in civil law. When it comes to criminal law, and we're talking about whether or not, you know, a 17-year-old consented to, you know, being punched or, you know, hit or some other, you know, activity by a 15-year-old, well, we don't want to categorically say that neither of those people can in any circumstance ever give consent. But we also
unless
need
to do so means we won't charge anybody with a crime. But if we're charging people with crimes as juveniles,
right?
Apparently, they can consent.
Right.
To shit.
So, right. So we want to say that again and again. To what extent can a, for instance, a parent consent to, on behalf of their child, to certain activities that then the person gets hurt? Right. Like. One of the things that's commonly talked about is sports activities where, you know, and there are some difficult fringe issues because, yeah, you maybe no, but, you know, there's no real concerns about an ordinary football game, right? You know, and one person recklessly harming the other. But then what about when it's a pickup game and there are no real rules and somebody just, like, you know, punches or, you know, throws an elbow, like, you know, like, okay, is this stepping outside the rules of the game? Was it agreed to? Is this among kids? Was it consented to by, you know, like, there are cases on this, right? Like, in other jurisdictions, not here. And again, it really hits some sticky issues. The district's never dealt with this before, right? Like, again, because we have common law, you know, we have a very mushy case law on simple assault, and it hasn't delved into this. So, we're trying to be very sensitive to that, but I want to flag it for everybody in looking at the specific defenses. Again, we're not doing general defenses, but we have been, in the assault statute that we put forward, you know, try to address some specific defenses that, you know, once you start to codify, you know, simple assault, and you know, we think need to be addressed. All right. A couple other things to flag. You know, generally in the offenses against persons, robbery, assault, menace, threats, you know, if you, I don't know what stage you are in your opportunity to review things, but, you know, I think the biggest change is kind of how we're trying to integrate the many penalty enhancements out there into the offenses. And I wanted to flag that, actually, as we've been working on child neglect and some of the vulnerable adult and elderly abuse statutes. We, not final, because we haven't finalized it yet, but this is something we'll release in March for this next set of recommendations. I think that will also deal with assaultive conduct against a child or an elderly person, right? As is the case under current law. And so we may be, as we address these additional offenses, it may be that we don't need, for instance, an enhancement in the assault statute for minors and seniors if we're providing it over here for in the child abuse and abuse of a elderly person statute. So I just want to say that, you know, kind of, you know, we're trying to sort that out now. There may be some changes, even from our point of view, on like where that those enhanced penalties come from. They will still be there in some form, but you know where that might shift. You know, there is a fundamental question, right, as to whether to do what we've kind of pitched in these recommendations of integrating the enhancements versus keeping them separate, and then somehow creating some rules about how the free, you know, separate enhancements work together. Right now, the code is structured in a way that, right, there are many separate thing, you know, enhancements floating out there. There's no rules or law as to how, you know, how they can stack or the courts have tried to deal with this, the WildArm enhancement's a big one, does that merge, does that not, with, PFCOV, possession of firearm and crime of violence. Statutes just don't deal with this stuff. Case law has gone some way towards it, but our way of trying to deal with this was to integrate them into the statute so you can see how these work, and it's the model that most jurisdictions, other jurisdictions follow, at least in something like assault, right? Like, they draw these things into the statute. So that's what we're doing, but it is, it would be I would encourage it, if you have strong thoughts about keeping them separate as kind of an organizational matter, yeah, would love to hear that. I flagged in the memo, we haven't addressed PFCOV, right, in this. Possibility, and it is still possible, is to kind of have a broaden it to include dangerous weapons, so that while again for the revised assault statute robbery they include use of weapons in the gradations, that the other thing you would have out there besides the these offenses against persons where the gradations take account of the use of a weapon, you would also have a separate PFCOV-like offense, which is merely possession, right? So not use, but just a kind of a baseline possession of, again, under current law, it's really limited to firearms. I think one thing we're considering is broadening that out to other prohibited weapons, the Bowie knife, right? Something like that. So I just want to kind of let you know, kind of in this framework that we're trying to put out there to clean it up, that that's where we're heading. So it would be use of the weapon in the gradations themselves, and then a separate possession offense, And what this would do, in some sense, limits the regime we have now is more complicated than any other jurisdiction we've seen in terms of having, we have possession level offenses, we have readily available level offenses, we have while armed level offenses, and then in a few instances we have the actual use of the weapon. We have these four levels in which we're in different offenses, in different ways, and in different enhancements, trying to talk about the weapons involvement, and we want to streamline that to kind of two levels: the use of the weapon as part of the offense, or just possession. Just clean that up, so we don't have these many different gradations. Say a couple more things. My voice is failing me a little bit. We did not address merger in this last batch. Some of it, obviously there are implications for how an elements test, right? Is assault a lesser included offense of robbery? Just the way they're written. You can read that and make your own kind of determination, and the courts would, if that were passed into law, as to whether those are lesser included. But whether and how we want to go further and kind of say something more about, robbery is kind of a classic composite offense involving a theft and an assault. And, just as burglary, would be, intent to commit a crime and a trespass. These are composite offenses. Does the assaultive act that is part of a robbery mean that any convictions for assault and that robbery using that assault, do they necessarily merge? We haven't addressed that. We're still trying to OAG it on the property offenses, kind of pitched know, kind of how to deal with merger for these kinds of similar offenses, and allowing, not putting in a merger rule or dealing with it even at sentencing, but saying, fine, you know, go forward with your charges of these overlapping offenses. You can convict on overlapping offenses, assuming it doesn't violate, again, kind of a elements test, constitutional. But then take it on up through appeal, and at that level, you know, OIG's pitch was, you know, once it, appeals are exhausted, then there would be some automatic kind of kick out for these overlapping offenses. We haven't put together language on that, right? But that same sort of mechanism that would, you know, we talked about for property offenses and kind of OIG kind of put in this alternative, could be adopted in the offenses against persons framework for, again, offenses where they significantly overlap, but, you know, not entirely. Again, we'll try to address this more going forward. In this first batch, we it's getting a little ahead of ourselves, so we thought to like talk about merger before we even kind of have some of these basics about language and gradations and how the offenses are being split up decided. But that remains out there. All right, that's kind of the overview I wanted to give, like to highlight some of those things. Again, this written out in the memo, advisory group memo number 15. But with that said, I wanted to just kind of open it up for questions you might have. Again, there's criminal attempts, as well as, again, these offenses against persons. And, right, things that we can clarify or that would be helpful to kind of, you know, really discuss as a group at this stage of the game. Yeah, so wanted to open it up for any comments. And I would also add that, you know, and several of you have taken advantage of this before, you know, if you would just want to also, like, call later on, right? Like, you know, and just say, like, you know, what were you getting at here? You know, is this, it might be that regardless, you want to put it in writing as a comment, but you also might want to, like, kind of gauge, like, are we substantively on the same page? And I'm just, like, kind of, like, something about the drafting that's throwing me off here. Happy to talk through any of these issues. Just, you know, give us a call in the coming weeks. And, yep, so put that out there, too, as an option for everybody.
Do you have data on the attempts now? Like, how many people are sentenced on attempt robbery and how many people are sentenced on attempt burglary?
Right. We do. We just last week got the data, but we haven't analyzed it yet. So, very soon, we hope to. And I don't remember, maybe it was kind of at the beginning, kind of mentioned, like, we hope to have
that. That you got that data.
Yeah. So, but we haven't kind of yet seen kind of how that breaks out, or again, then where the numbers go, right? You know, look, attempted robbery is obviously going to be, you know, a suspected focus for you, right? You know, it's a place where we have this somewhat anomalous separate statute, you know, separate section devoted to a 3-year, you know, less than other crimes of violence, which otherwise is the default 5. You know, there's history behind that. You know, I would say, you know, again, part of our wanting to get out the attempt penalties was to, with this assault, is like, you know, from our perspective, it's this whole constellation of the assault with the intent to commit robbery, right? Like, often, not always, but often is overlapping or is fully provable from the same fact patterns that you would have robbery or an attempted robbery. So we wanted that to be the whole package. Now, again, how you all know much better, kind of like the nuances and, you know, why things are charged or end up, you know, pleading a certain way when there are multiple, right, you know, charges that you could go on for a robbery or whether it's assault with intent to commit robbery. You know, like, So that's why we wanted to put this whole package together.
Right.
And I would just say that, like, right, we're, you know.
Rich?
Yes.
Can I add another level of complication to the assault with intent to
please
issue? The question will come up, and I'm sure there are already people who will fall on either side of this, about Title 16 offenses, 16-23-01, you know, who's charged as an adult between the ages of 16 and 18. And the way that Congress wrote that is it lists out, like, murder, first-degree, sexual assault, robbery in the first-degree, burglary one, or assault with intent to commit one of those offenses. So I don't know the implications of a changing in the way that we handle it in criminal code and how that ties back into sort of that structural framework.
Yep.
And I just want people to be aware of that, and then council can certainly do what it wants to do.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely right. I would say there, you know, it's also like, look, I think you mentioned this before, but, you know, the crime of violence definitions, right, also have to get messed with in some ways, right? Like, we're putting out multiple gradations, right, for robbery, whereas right now robbery is just the one gradation, right? Everything from pickpocketing to, you know, kind of serious, you know, violence. So, okay, so robbery is right now listed in the crime of violence definition. Would all the gradations of the revised, you know, if we proceeded with kind of what we have out in the first draft, would all those gradations of robbery count as crimes of violence? Maybe, maybe not, right? You know, same thing, you know, burglary, assault, you know, we're adding in more that, you know, like, we'll need to rethink these other places, Title 16, crime of violence, some other procedural, you know, provisions where usually what's happening is we're breaking up into more gradations, an offense or a couple of gradations of an offense, and we need to, you know, there have to be conforming amendments and rethink, like, okay, well, what does this still cover? And at this point, we don't. I think I think it's right to flag that, but I also think, like, we kind of can't get there to kind of gain, you know, see what those should be until we have a bit more solidity on, well, how many gradations are there, and what are these offenses, what are their elements? Then once we have that more together, we can kind of reevaluate and say, okay, well, what of these in the new framework? Which of these should be in the Title 16, or which of these should be covered by, you know, crime of violence? If there are other places, don't hesitate to keep flagging those for us, though, because I think, like, you know, if we miss it, and maybe it's just, you know, a comment just saying, like, you know, again, this kind of goes in the box of things that will need to be addressed down the road, you know, that we just want to keep track of is, you know, conforming amendments in Title 16 that address, you know, which particular offenses qualify for life, you know, prosecution. Laura has a...
No,
yes.
I'm not asking.
Okay.
I'm thinking.
Okay.
I have another point,
yeah,
in terms of the data. I mean, one reason that you say that the justification for increasing it to half for all attempts is because you have this anomalous thing where you can have an attempted first-degree murder be 5 years because of the crime of violence general attempt. But are people actually charged with that? It gets in footnote...
Yeah.
I think 96.
Yeah, yeah.
So it goes both ways, right? I mean, so in terms of what the recommendations were, is like, it was, you know, there are places where attempt penalties, right? So like MDP, for example, right? MDP is a situation where
what's MDP?
Malicious destruction of property. So it's like the same 10-year statutory maxima for the attempt and non, you know. So like that was an area where, you know, when you look at the whole picture of where things are going, the sort of like the most rational principle seemed to be like a 50% discount. In some places that boosts, in other places it decreases, but as a general sort of like organizing principle, that seemed like this, you know, the most justifiable, rational one. And then if there are places where there should be exceptions made, whether on the severity side or on the leniency side, right, we can make those. And so then it's just a question of which exceptions should those be. And so, you know, we're open to hearing those.
You know, I think we noted the, you know, some of the more recently reworked statutes, right? So not attempted robbery, but, you know, the sex abuse offenses, for instance. You know, they try to have a consistent, you know, 50%. It's something we see in other jurisdictions. You know, again, exceptions might be justified, but you know, this also comes to, like, I suspect everybody will want to see, like, well, what's the classification, right? You know, like, what's the maximum penalty for which then you're having 50%, right? I suspect all you guys are going to just, you know, like, you know, in terms of the numbers and the proportionality, right, for penalties, and that's partly why we can kind of, you know, push that off to kind of, like, let's think about the important distinctions, and then, you know, numbers, I expect there'll be disagreement on many issues. But, you know, right, whether it ends up going up or down for a particular offense, it's complicated, right? Like, you know, we now have, like, you know, our pitches for robbery becoming not just one robbery, it's becoming, you know, multiple gradations. So, in a sense, we're giving one attempt penalty at 50%. In another way, it's like we're actually giving four new attempt penalties, some low, some high. It just kind of, you know, depends on where everything, you know, where those classes go.
Right, and then the wall armed, which adds like a block 40 or whatever, two.
With a slingshot.
What's that?
With a slingshot.
Right, and so I'm saying in terms of gaming out, you know, I think that there, you know, there are definitely places where it seems like the top number would be going up, and there are definitely places where it seems like it's going down. And this is even right now at a very general level. There are numbers that go that are accompanied with the specific gradations being made. You know, it'll be the better sense of like where specifically things are going, and then at that point we can make whatever exceptions seem appropriate.
Right, but I think the data would be helpful to know whether this is really advocating for more mass incarceration.
Yeah,
if there are certain crimes that are just across the board, the ones that people are sentenced under, and we're going to see a tripling.
Sure. The one thing I would put out there, again, future conversation more about, you know, kind of proportionality, is, you know, assuming we go forward with, you know, something like what we put in this first draft, it's hard to model what the future is going to be based on the past data. Because again, the categories are kind of shifted, right? Like, so again, like robbery, it is opaque to us, right? What's going on right now in the courts in robbery? Like, I mean, you know, we can get anecdotal, you know, kind of sense of this. Oh, it seems like a lot of, you know, most robberies are not kind of low level pickpocketing, jostling. Most are more serious. Well, are most, you know, involving something that would constitute, you know, significant bodily injury if it was charged as an assault. Well, you know, like, no, we can't track that now. And yet when we put out new gradations, right, and we're breaking it up, it's kind of inherently difficult to kind of see how that would change going forward. I think, you know, also, like, you know, if we were addressing merger rules, right? So right now, you know, again, you've got, you know, PFCOV, standing apart from, you know, while armed enhancement for robbery, right? Okay, well, so that's a whole nother piece, right? That, like, you know, in the constellation of a particular robbery that happens in that fact pattern, what could be charged and brought and sentenced, there are many aspects that could happen there, and we're kind of changing the boxes for how that behavior can be divided up. And ultimately, how prosecutors decide to proceed with those boxes, I don't know. So I guess I would caution drawing any direct inference from short of decriminalizing conduct, right? Like, you know, and we're not doing that, you know, like, but, you know, short of that, it's very hard to kind of draw a line between current practice and kind of how things will work with these new boxes and new penalties, right, and the maxima.
Last thing I would just add is that it's important, you know, not to overstate the importance of statutory maxima. So, you know, I don't know the specifics of our theft data, but right, so there's a 10-year statutory maxima on felony theft, and, you know, I think, like, you rarely, or even if ever, get above, like, what, 5 years? You know, so it's like, just because there is a statutory maxima doesn't necessarily, you know, doesn't, I mean, it's important, and
it might shift it for guidelines purposes, right? Because that's what's driving the theft, and it will definitely shift it for how much supervised release people get.
Maybe. How do guidelines respond to this? The boxes are changed for guidelines too, right? Like, one of the notable aspects, you know, is, you know, when the guidelines were first being developed in the early 2000s, I don't know, you know, Laura, you were on when this was, you know, like, you know, there was talk in the records, or I know from reading the records that, you know, like, there was talk about, like, being more refined, right, in how, for instance, robbery is treated in is there a pickpocketing form of robbery? Can't deal with the statute, but at least in the guidelines. They ended up not going that way, right? So a lot of these boxes are still kind of monolithic in the guidelines, right? And so even there, by us statutorily teasing apart these different levels of robbery, it will require at least some rethinking of, okay, well, now that we're clear there's pickpocketing form of robbery, theft from a person, you know, that needs to be treated differently. I mean, so I don't know that the existing guideline categories are also necessarily, you can draw a one-to-one translation of here it is now, here's where it will be. But yeah, look, I definitely hear your sentiment that, like, seeing the data on where things are now would be really helpful. Again, we hope to do more with that soon. And I would say, again, as you all kind of know, you know, like, you know, the Sentencing Commission has at least released even publicly, although you can find, you know, the felony level data for 5 years, you know, 2010 to 2015. And that, you know, just, last week was kind of looking at some of the stats there. You can begin to pull some interesting, let's see, I'm gonna pull it up on the screen right now. Anyway, you know, you can sort out and find some of these answers to some of these questions. Now, this actually isn't gonna do it for us, I don't think. I will say a caveat that we're gonna look into shortly on attempts. It's especially tricky, even when you have, from the court data, they've flagged it as an attempt charge. It's hard to always kind of tell what's going on with that, and it's not clear that clerks are kind of like using that. This is all their internal system, right? You know, like, they're just checking that box for attempt. But are they checking that box for attempt because it was something like arson, where you know, the offense definition includes attempts, okay, but it was argued in trial, you know, like, you know, like, it was, you know, everybody talked about it as attempt, but from our perspective, you know, it's not like it was relying on the general penalty for attempts of crime of violence, 5 years, 180 days, whatever. You know, they're not making, again, we need to look into this more, but it seems like from the data, they're not kind of flagging that. What we get is kind of a straight, like, was it an attempt or not? And so it's tricky, right? You know, again, sex abuse has its own kind of, you know, statutory section for attempts. Presumably, anytime we see in the court data, the attempt flag for a sex crime, it's under that. I should think so. But like, you know, we have to kind of tease this out for different things. So it's hard. I would say like it's hard to get a. It's hard to put together a picture of where attempt liability is going. Some things, the cleanest, perhaps, are robbery or where you actually have like a whole separate statutory section for it. We'll see. Again, if you look kind of like how the Sentencing Commission handled it, you know, like you'll see some attempts cropping up at times. Let's see if anything kind of quickly pops here. But the numbers are not that big. You know, there's an attempt, great, shows up. And again, this is from their public data. They don't actually give the statutory cite. Okay, so, you know, again, it's kind of hard to tease apart from what the they put online. What's the basis for it being called an attempt? And it may be because they don't know either. All that, they're just entering that because the box was checked in the core data. Anyway, so we'll try to flesh this out, the limitations on how much we can sort attempts.
Can I ask a question about fourth degree assault? I'm in report 15 at page 4. I'm sorry, I'll speak up for people on the phone, if anyone still is on the phone, has lasted. I am curious where this comes from. DC case law, model penal code, you all thought it up. Negligently, so it would be fourth degree assault to negligently cause bodily injury by means of a firearm, regardless of whether the firearm is loaded. Yep. Why is that? Why, if I use a firearm like a club,
sure,
negligently, is that so much worse than negligently using a club? Just curious where that
right.
came from.
So I can speak to that a bit, which is to say, in general, this was... I don't know if it was every reform jurisdiction, but most had, and this is you know, many jurisdictions don't have, they just have like, would have two grades of assault, but they would have a special negligent use of a firearm as a distinct category, even though they might have other wild arm type you know, offenses. And so right. The origin of this is simply like, this appears to be like, there's a best practice. This was pretty strongly supported by what we saw in other jurisdictions. Now, more specific, and it would be a negligent standard for use of the firearm. Now, the clause about, you know, regardless of where the firearm is loaded, that's coming from this definition and kind of some of the case law that we do have in the district as to, we're trying to be consistent in using that same definition. Yeah. If your point is like the use of it as a club versus
my point is I can. I'll sit close to Akasha so she can kick me. Yeah. I can imagine saying that we don't object to negligently causing bodily injury by means of what, in fact, is a firearm. Because you're using it as a firearm. Mm-hmm. But an unloaded firearm, right. is that,
right?
Right? So there's lots
yep.
of ways,
yep.
right? Criminal menace, I get it,
yeah.
right? But this,
yeah.
this seems
it's
that,
good, the,
it's
yeah.
the it's the loaded part, or right. the fact that it might not be, that strikes me, you know,
okay.
we're not,
yeah,
not shooting somebody with an unloaded firearm. I don't
well,
know a lot about
compare
guns,
to
but I think so.
Assault while armed
you mean
in jurisdictions where they've done. I mean, are they trying
sure.
to get
it's
around?
It's a mental state issue. It's the lowered mental state, and I assume we haven't dug into like case law around this, but my guess is where the cases are coming from. You've got a loaded weapon, and you accidentally, you know. Accidentally, negligently,
club person?
Shoot somebody.
No.
So putting aside
so
the clubbing
so
issue,
like, it's
that
like,
I get.
Yeah.
It's like that.
Get.
It's like the case where the person drops their purse and the gun
goes
off.
Yeah.
That ends
like,
up being
exactly.
manslaughter
exactly.
in that case. But if it was injury,
that's right.
okay, that's stupid.
That's
this is
but I dropped my purse, and mine is an
that's
unloaded
right.
firearm, and Renata
yeah.
drops her purse, and she's carrying a baseball bat.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. No, and that's, it's
her
kind of hard to imagine just, like,
you
I mean,
baseball bat.
The fact pattern where this happens, where it's unloaded, is... It's kind of just hard to imagine, right? Like, you know, pistol whipping a person, it's hard to, how do you negligently do that?
Okay.
Not like, so I hear you saying it's confusing and just as a matter of culpability, just kind of wrong to talk about an unloaded firearm. You know, I agree, like, I don't know when that would ever come up. So the only reason we've done this and kept that phrase in was just, again, in pretty much any other case where we're talking about firearms in the district as a you know as an enhancement, we don't care if it was you know loaded or not, right? Like, you know, the case law is pretty much like, well, it's a firearm. It was a firearm, and, you know, and we're not looking at whether it was loaded or not. So that's why we just kind of imported that over. But yeah, we'll definitely kind of look at that, and I think it's a good point to look at whether there should be an exception here for at least, you know, if you're going to do this kind of thing with negligence, then it should be only for loaded firearms. Other thoughts or questions? Class out a little early, just a little early today.
Only
right.
a little.
All right.
For a meeting
right.
started with. This might not be a long meeting.
Yeah, you never know. We never know.
You did it.
Well, there we go. All right, thank you all. And again, just a reminder to, you know, don't hesitate to call us if, you know, something comes up. You want to talk through. I believe it again was March 3rd on this batch of documents. And again, I mentioned this before, but I'll mention again, you know, the next things we're kind of working on are homicide, murder and manslaughter, child abuse, child neglect, elder and vulnerable adult abuse, neglect, on the general part, kind of some solicitation as an offense. So that's going to be kind of the next crop of stuff to come out. And, you know, because we're doing it back-to-back, some of this, like, we're assuming some of the basics in the way that kind of these are drafted and structured, we're trying to be consistent with that. You know, it turns out we get back comments and we end up having to rejigger this. Well, we'll probably have to rejigger kind of the way we're doing kind of child abuse and neglect and some of this other. But that's kind of where we're proceeding for now.
And what's timing? So this is
early March,
despite requests due.
March 2nd.
Very early March. I said March 3rd, so I was going to actually say the date. We're going to go with the oral. Anyway, but then there's a meeting next week, which presumably would be people talking about what we've just. You may not have gotten the comments, like we. Maybe you will expect us to have read comments submitted, but presumably the next meeting we'll be talking about
the March.
What you will have forced us to just turn in. And then around then is when you'll get up the next set for some due date that's like
right,
April, May?
That's
June, July?
Has not been set to be determined. Yes. So, like, you know, right, for what will the agenda be for the March meeting? It will be primarily comments that we receive back on this batch. And then if there are questions, again, you will have only had it for a matter of, you know, days, the kind of new batch on child abuse, child neglect, solicitation, homicide. I doubt we'll get there, right? Unless nobody has any comments on this round. That's what we'll spend that March meeting on. That answer your question?
even if
yeah, it was a little bit about the timing of the next set of reports, but that's fine.
Okay,
that's fine.
Yeah,
like
and
when
the,
you
the back end,
sending it out, whatever.
Yeah,
that's
on the back end, I'm not sure about that. Okay. Like, you know, we're always, yeah. Any other thoughts, questions, concerns? Not, we'll call it a meeting. Thank you all, and thanks particularly to Dave calling
all right.
in on
take care, everyone.
Hard day there. Okay.
Feel better.
Thanks.
Yeah,
take care.
Okay. Bye.
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 Bye. Bye.